thank the organizers for inviting me to come and speak here. As recently as 6 months ago, I was really dreading this conference because, you know, it's been about 5 years, I guess, that there's been all these projected connections between planar algebras and subfactors on the one hand and, you know, random matrices and free probability on the other. And I've already given the occasional talk, you know, sort of saying that there should be this connection, there should be that connection, but it was all pie in the sky. And I was really hating the idea I might have to give such a talk again in front of, you know, sort of. But fortunately, Elise Guionnet has been at Berkeley, was at Berkeley last year, and thanks to her presence and persistence, eventually, well, we did manage to make a what seems to be a genuine and hopefully extremely fruitful connection between planar algebras and subfactors on the one hand and free probability and random matrices on the other. So that's what I want to talk about. So the real title should be that. It's a bit longer, so I just included the first couple of terms in the perturbative expansion. It should be in alphabetical order. These ones, anyway. All right, so these are my collaborators, and we still hard at it. Okay, so of course, the good thing about writing a joint paper with Dima is you eventually find out how to spell his name after you go wrong enough times. So I think this is right, Dima. So. Okay, well, that's another question. All right, so fortunately for me, I at least managed to go over just about everything this morning that I wanted to start off with, but let me go over it again in a way that probably gets all of the normalization constants wrong and therefore shows you the depth of understanding you need to get beyond the beginning here. So basically what she was talking about today was trying to figure out the large n limit of an integral like that. So you have k Hermitian n by n matrices, and you have some word w on these Hermitian matrices, and you want to integrate over all matrices. So with ordinary Lebesgue measure over all of these matrices, and then you have this Gaussian term, e to the minus n. I hope the n is right. It shouldn't be 1 over n or n squared or something. That's right. Okay, good. Times the L2 norm. So that's the Gaussian part that's going to make everything converge and reasonably nice. And then you have a coupling constant beta times the trace of some other expression which we're going to call a potential. And in Elisa's talk, I think it was always a monomial. And then if you wanted to handle non-monomials, you had to do linear combinations of monomials. Or you could take different betas for each one. Okay, but a priori, well, one of the things that's going to come out of this is it would be a nice way to handle at least homogeneous expressions without going to monomials. Although, and then there's some normalizing factor to make it all a probability measure. So as I said, what we're interested in is the large n behavior of this. We want to see what happens as n tends to infinity, and we only want to take the leading term. And if you do only take the leading term, what you get is this answer, which Elise gave us already in her talk, and this is just another version of the same picture. So better get used to this picture, though, because this is going to be the main thing in this talk, really, is these pictures like this. So here's an example. Here's the word whose expectation value we're trying to find. So in this case, it's a squared b to the fourth a squared. We just write it along a line like that. And then v, the potential, which just for illustration here, I'm going to take as a monomial, of degree 4 in this picture, gets put in all of these internal disks in various numbers for each k. So we do this expansion, in this picture I've given k is equal to 4 because there's 4 of these internal disks, And of course, it's also of degree four, so there's two confusing fours that are perhaps confusingly the same. I suppose I could fix that, couldn't I? Let me not bother. Anyway, you have the sum of all possible ways of connecting these four internal disks to the boundary. And if they're monomials, what you do is you only count the ones in which so this word, which is the potential here, goes inside these little internal disks, and there's a distinguished starting point for each internal disk. And you only count the ones where an A is connected to an A is connected to an A, and so on, and B is connected to B. Okay? So, and then you take the, so this is supposed to be, this extension and powers of beta is supposed to be the large M limit, if you appropriately normalize to get rid of all of these slower growing terms in N of that integral over all matrices. So far, I don't think I've said anything that's really terribly wrong. Okay. Just, you know, I haven't given you what the constants are because I'm completely incapable of that. Alright, so, let me see. Another great thing about these transparencies talks is you always surprise yourself by what actually appears on the next transparency. So the philosophy here, as Alice also explained this morning, is that we think of these integrals as defining a trace on the algebra of non-commutative polynomials, self-adjoint polynomials, in a bunch of variables, k variables. The k might already be doing double duty. All right. So now, if we, and then the idea was, and this I think was the idea in the joint work of Alice and Dina, which sort of motivated me in this, was to use that trace to complete this algebra to a Feynman algebra. Maybe just a C-star algebra by usual GNS stuff. And then what Alice and Dima did was they studied properties of these Feynman C-star algebras, such as, you know, is it a factor? Do you get a factor? Does the C-star algebra have any projections? Okay, what kind of factor do you get? And answers are pretty hard to come by because this trace is quite complicated. You know, the combinatorics of that expression, because you're actually summing over all possible ways of connecting up these things, is rather complicated. But they did establish this result that under suitable these convexity conditions, the series actually converges, the series that I wrote down of these sums actually converges for small beta. Well, I believe that's not really the tools they used to prove the properties about the factor. It was more sort of the string of Dyson and the free, stochastic differential equations with the free Brownian motion. Okay. So anyway, this is so. All right. So now, you know, we spent at least 6 months just talking to each other, Alice and I, and sort of talking to each other's complete ignorance, and then finally, something got through that actually worked. And it's a very simple observation. And it's something that I, of course, had known for since the early days of subfactors. And that is that non-commutative polynomials are an example of a planar algebra. Okay, and here is the planar algebra structure. So I'm going to tell you in more detail what a planar algebra is shortly, but here's the guts of it in this particular example. If you have a bunch of polynomials, three of them in this picture, 1, 2, 3, then you can insert them into the internal disk of one of these pictures and get out another polynomial on the external disk. And the way you do it is that you just put the variables on the edges here, so x, 1, all of the variables on the edges. A polynomial, a non-commutative polynomial, every time it sees a sort of monomial, it gives you its coefficient. Okay, and when you do that, and each time you've put one of the variables on each of these edges, you get the product of the corresponding coefficients, multiply, and then add over all possible ways of putting the x's, the variables, on the edges. And that gives you, since you had to fix the ones on the edge, so on the outside of here you're going to have to specify a choice of variables, that gives you the coefficient of the monomial around the outside. Okay? So that is the plane, yeah. Okay, let me say it again. I'll say exactly the same thing the second time around, maybe you'll understand. So, I want to take, in this case, three non-commutative polynomials and come out with another one, somehow in a natural way from this picture. Okay? So what do I need to give? I need to give you a coefficient for each monomial. Right? I put the monomial around the boundary. Okay? This is the specified starting point, as you know, these pictures. I put the monomial around the boundary, and then I let the variables extend over the edges of this diagram. So they will go as far as the nearest thing that they're connected to. Okay? On the mark points of the boundary. And then I extend it along the edges. Okay, and this one, for instance, will extend back to where? And so you're only going to get something non-zero if you have a coherent. You know, that has to be constant along all of the curves. Okay? Now we're going to also sum over all possible ways of putting the variables on these edges as well, the internal edges as well. Okay? So once we've put all of the edges, a choice of variables on each of the edges, what does this guy see? It sees around it, it sees a monomial. It sees a word and the x's. So does this one, so does this one. Since it's a polynomial, it has a coefficient. Okay? Take that coefficient, do that for all three of these disks, multiply them together, you get a number, add over all possible ways of doing so the internal vertices, internal edges, and you've got the coefficient of the polynomial around the boundary on that thing. Now, another way of saying this, of course, which is basically what I used to say, is these are just monomials. If P1, P2, and P3 are just monomials, then you only get a contribution when everything's consistent. Okay? Otherwise it's going to be zero, and you get a little sum here when these things touch the boundary. So it's exactly what, at least, in other words, if you just restrict to monomials, you see exactly what Alice was telling us this morning. But this extends it to the whole planar algebra immediately. Okay, so this was the simple observation. It's, Joy didn't understand it, but he's a little slow sometimes. you got it now. This was a simple observation that allowed us to make the connection with the planar algebras and so on. So what the extension will do, this is where the graded product will come in. The product in the algebra of non-commutative polynomials will be replaced by what's going to be this graded product coming from a planar algebra. Okay, that's just, non-commutative polynomials just concatenation, so we're going to be able to concatenate elements in an arbitrary planar algebra. And so that's how the generalization will go. So there's a lot of stuff that hopefully will come out of this. And so far, I just want to emphasize two things. The first one is is we get matrix models, some kind of matrix models, to every time we have a bipartite graph. We have an explicit matrix model, and we also actually have to give ourselves in the case where the graph is infinite, we have to give ourselves a Perron-Frobenius eigenvector for the adjacency matrix of the graph. Okay, once we have that data, we can construct a matrix model to which we could add potentials and so on, with a Gaussian part and so on, large N limit and so on. And hopefully Dima will say something about that in his talk. I will skip that and concentrate on the second part, which is of particular interest to me. As we get a new, relatively new proof of a theorem of Popper, which is about 10 years old, I guess, which says that to every planar algebra there is a subfactor, such that the invariance of the subfactor is the planar algebra you started with. Okay? And that was sort of notoriously non-hyperfinite 2-1 factor that Sorin came up with. Now, the reason that I'm extremely happy about this is that I have to confess that after running through Serene's papers several times in my seminar, studying it on myself, thinking about how I could never, ever, ever come to grips with Serene's construction. So now I have one that I understand, and it's somehow minimal. It doesn't use any extra data, doesn't amalgamate free product with something completely arbitrary. It just uses the data of the planar algebra. Okay? So that's what I want to talk about today. Now, probably the most exciting thing about this work and the sort of ongoing stuff is this last thing, which is potentials. So to do this number two, in fact, number one and number two, there's no explicit potential present, but you know, we can sort of try starting to add potentials to the story. And the idea is that, you know, we haven't been doing nothing in planar algebra for the last 15 years. We have discovered some rather interesting results. Elements of planar algebra have very interesting relations among them, which I call skein relations, which allow you to manipulate pictures with this, you know, with this element stuck in all over the place. So hopefully, and it's a big hope, but you know, this, hopefully, one can actually use the skein theory to manipulate these sums over all possible ways of putting these potentials in the picture. So that's very early days, but a lot of hard work still has to be done, but I think that's possibly the most interesting direction to go in. And if I have time, I'll say more about that at the end. So be more explicit. Okay, so on to the next thing. So, right, so I said that what I was going to do was explain this new proof of Serene's theorem. So I have to go back to the beginning and tell you properly what a planar algebra is with a bit more structure. Now, I've been criticized heavily, not least by myself, for insisting on rather special conditions, requiring rather special conditions of a planar algebra. This is really because of the relationship with subfactors, and in fact, Brewer here forced me to allow the term to be used for more general things than this. But anyway, so for the context of subfactors, not necessarily free probability, but subfactors, the kind of tangles that I'm going to talk about are going to have all the structure that I put in here. So you have internal disks, in this case 1, 2, 3 internal disks. You have an external disk, and each of these disks has a distinguished starting point or starting interval, which you indicate by putting a star. There's at least three different uses of star in this talk. A star near the beginning point. So if you think of going around clockwise, going around everything, then star, the first string will come straight after it. Or you can think of star as being sitting on the first interval, whichever you prefer. There's actually reasons it's better to have it be the intervals on the disks rather than the strings. But anyway, so there's that data, and then there's the shading. The dreaded shading. I'm going to insist that all of the disks have an even number of strings coming in and out of them, and there's a checkerboard, so therefore there is a checkerboard shading. I'm going to choose one, and that's going to be part of the data of the tangle. Right. So all of this goes into the tangle. Now, so what is a planar algebra? Well, a planar algebra is supposed to be a vector space for each n. I've been a bit short on the details here. Each vector space has an involution star. It has absolutely nothing to do with this star. And there's what I call an action of the tangles on the vector spaces. And that means what I already illustrated, I guess, in the simple case before of non-commutative polynomials. You get to put, whenever you see one of these tangles, you get to put elements of the vector spaces in each of the internal disks. And the vector space that it comes from is half the number of boundary points. So in this case, in this particular tangle, I would get to put in an element of P3 in this one because there's 6 boundary points, an element of P2 in that one because there's 4 boundary points, P2 in that one, and I would get out an element of P3 because there's 6 boundary points on the big one. Okay? So that's the main axiom, that's the main structure of a planar algebra. Every time you have a tangle, you have this operation on the vector spaces, and it's multilinear. Okay? Multilinear. So all you need to do is specify it on basis elements. Alright? And since we're talking for Norman C star, the star of these vector spaces is compatible with, everything's supposed to be only true up to isotropy. You're allowed to push all these pictures around a bit. But if you do an orientation reversing diffeomorphism, then that has to go along with, you have to apply the involution on the vector spaces in order to have the compatibility with the operations. Okay? So I'm saying this very briefly, you know, if you just think about these terms, you'll see that what I'm saying is, you know, makes perfect sense. And finally, of course, there's something which I didn't even put down here. There's a compatibility, a sort of homomorphism relationship between these operations on the vector spaces and the tangles themselves, because you can start gluing tangles, you know, you can think of this, if you have another appropriate tangle, you can sort of glue another one inside there and you get another tangle. And then when you start adding the vectors, there's two different ways to do it, two different orders to do it. And the compatibility is just that those two orders give you the same thing. You either put the vectors in before the gluing, or you can put the vectors in after the gluing, you're supposed to get the same thing. So that's a reasonably general notion of planarity. If you took away the stars and if you took away the shading and the even things, you get even more general. But now here's kind of specific conditions relevant to subfactors of finite index. The first one is that I want all of these PNs to be finite dimensional, complex finite dimensional vector spaces. Okay? These conditions, of course, can be weakened, and there's still interesting stuff, but this is what I'm going to call a subfactor planar algebra. We'll have these conditions. First, they're all finite dimensional. Second, the P0. And I want to avoid subtleties to do with the shading. The P0, the zero space for the planar algebra, has dimension 1. Okay? This corresponds to the factor condition. The P0, of course, ends up being the center. So it has to have dimension 1. And that has the consequence that this little calculation here, if I have a disk and then it's slightly unfortunate, but this thing here is a disk and this thing here is a string. They should probably be different colors because they're quite different objects. So you have a disk with no marked boundary points, and then you have just a little circle there doing nothing in particular inside it. Then there has to be a scalar, right? Because it's one-dimensional, and you can canonically identify it with the complex numbers because this particular one has to be one for obvious reasons. So every planar algebra, therefore, has a scalar, a subfactor planar algebra, has a scalar, which I'm going to call delta, some people call it D. It's a positive, by these axioms somewhere along the line, it's a positive real number, and it corresponds, of course, in the subfactor game to the square root of the index of the subfactor, positive square root. All right, so that's an axiom, and there's an obvious consequence of it. Every subfactor comes along with a number, and whenever you see a circle in a picture, maybe you see it's just a little round string, and maybe it's not so round, but a closed curve, you throw it away as provided you multiply it by this factor delta. All right, third axiom is very important, and this is the positive positivity. If you have, you can define an inner product. If the dimension of P0 is equal to 1, then if you take A and you put in B star, and you put them in this tangle, then you've ended up in your P0, right? You're in P0, there's no boundary points here, so that's a scalar also. Because of the star, that makes it conjugate, makes it cislinear, so you've got a potential inner product, and the axiom is that that's positive definite. So each of the PNs, therefore, has to be a finite-dimensional Hilbert space with this particular Hilbert space structure. Then there's a thing about spherical rays that I'm just going to skip, because I have to get into these shadings a little bit. All right, so that's what a planar algebra is. So now some examples, maybe, because otherwise I don't want to be example free for too long. What was that? 4, 5, 6. Oh, I'm still example free. A couple of general properties before I give examples. So each of the individual vector spaces of a planar algebra is an algebra of its own right. And here's the multiplication. Where the structure comes from the various tangles. You use a tangle, you get a structure. So if we use this particular tangle, and we stick an A in and a B, then it's very easy to check that that's an associative operation. See, it's A times B, A and P3 and B in P3 gives you another element of P3. It's an associative operation, and it's a star algebra. It makes them into a star algebra. So each of the individual PNs in a plane algebra is, in its own right, finite-dimensional C-star algebra. Right. Now, there's also there's other special tangles, and if you choose your axioms right, you have to be slightly careful. You find that each one of these pictures like this, which are traditionally called temporally lead diagrams, they should probably be called Kaufman diagrams, each one of these pictures actually gives an element of the planar algebra. Okay, it's a mapping from, anyway, it gives you an element, and in fact the existence of these elements is in the sort of yoga of operators is corresponds to being a unital algebra over the operator. Anyway, that's just verbiage. Point is, every time you have one of these pictures, you get an element of your temporally lead algebra. They may or may not be linearly independent. Okay, still example free. My apologies. Don't like doing this. And back in the old days, in the good old days, in the 80s, in the early 90s perhaps, there was a construction that was supposed to give a subfactor from a planar algebra. And it's supposed to give a subfactor that gave you back the planar algebra as its invariance. So, and here it is, you just take the big factor, you know, each one of these PNs is actually embedded as a vector space in the next one by this particular. So if you have X in PN, then this particular tangle with the stars here and here puts it inside PN minus PN plus 1. So this sends PN, and with the axioms it's injective into PN plus 1. And this is obviously an algebra morphism, preserves algebra structure. So in fact we get an increase of the PNs form an increasing sequence of finite dimensional C-star algebras. And of course you happily take the direct limit, and then you'll try to complete that with respect to a trace, where the trace, of course, this is the trace. So these external disks are going to slowly disappear in the course of the talk because they're basically redundant. They're just drawing them as a bit of a pain. So strictly speaking, I should have an external disk around here, right? Element of P0, scalar, throw it away. And eventually these ones are going to disappear too, so just for the time being I'll keep them there. Okay, so we have an inductive, a very familiar situation in operator algebras. We have an AF C-star algebra and we have a trace on it, so we complete it and we should get a 2-1 factor. And the subfactor will be sort of the things in which the first string goes straight down. So this gives you the inclusion one way, and this gives you some elements, the subalgebra of it. Okay, and the old world was that that subfactor, hyperfinite, 2-1 subfactor, and it should reproduce the invariance that, you know, there's this standard invariant of a subfactor, which I'm not going to explain, unfortunately. Whenever you have a subfactor of finite index, there is a planar algebra or lambda lattice or power group or whatever you want to call it, which is the invariance. And the idea was that this subfactor you constructed from the planar algebra should reproduce the planar algebra as its invariance. So start with planar algebra, do this construction, get a subfactor, invariance of that subfactor should be the planar algebra you started with. Okay? And that's all beautiful and it all works provided you're in the situation of finite depth and maybe strong amenability. But there is a situation with finite depth, which is the world of TQFT, and so on, where that construction works like a gem, like a charm, and you know, you get everything you could possibly want. However, not all planar algebras have this finite depth condition. I should say, just in a word, if you've never seen it before, one way to say it is it's the rationality of the generating functions for the dimensions. That's the same thing as finite depth. Not all planar algebras are that by any means, like most of the interesting ones aren't. And so it wasn't obvious that that this process would work. In fact, it's known that this process fails several ways when it's not finite depth. But Popper had this marvelous theorem, as I was saying, that's the one that I never really managed to internalize. That said, that even in the infinite depth situation, there's another construction which gives you a non-hyperfinite factor, so it's not an inductive limit thing at all, which actually realizes, gives these non-hyperfinite factors, which gives the the planar out of the back as their invariant. Okay, and I think that with Dima, they proved that they could actually do it, provided they chose their data right, they could make sure everything was happening in the free group on infinitely many generators, using free probability techniques. Right, so that's the old story. Now, so more things going on here. Another thing that is associated with a principal, with a planar algebra, is this principal graph. It's a theorem that given a planar algebra, a subfactor planar algebra, there is a graph, possibly infinite, with a smart point in its star, such that the vector space is Pn, as vector spaces are nothing but loops on the graph beginning and ending at star. Okay, so in terms of generating functions and so on, and growth and so on, you're looking at a graph and counting loops on the graph. Okay, and that's all it is, as vector spaces. Alright, now, so now finally, examples. There is a way to, given any bipartite graph, let's make it finite to avoid some problems with this problem for Frobenius. Given any bipartite graph, which is made up of two bipartite halves, gamma 1 and gamma 2, you can look at all paths, all loops on gamma. So gamma is something like, this. So here's the gamma 1 and here's gamma 2. You can start anywhere here and look at loops of length 2n. So you have to come back to here. Then if you take those loops of length 2n as a vector space, then you can make on that vector space, on those vector spaces, you can make a planar algebra structure which has everything that was required in the axioms except the dimension of P0 being equal to 1. So one philosophy has been to look inside these planar algebras for ones, for subfactor ones. It's sort of that's been a fairly fruitful endeavor. Okay, so that's an example of a planar algebra. How does the planar algebra structure go? Well, it's just a generalization of the one that I explained in great detail before. Instead, you know, you have linear combinations of these loops, and you sort of put the loops around here, loops around here, loops around here, and provided everything's compatible, you get an answer to be the coefficient of the loop that you read around there. And if the other things don't line up, you know, the paths don't line up in the regions, and the paths go, the vertices of the graph go there, 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 and there, and the paths go, you know, the edges go across there. And so if the regions don't all agree, then you get zero. You can imagine, I hope, how it might work. And then there's a nasty factor, a lot of interest there, really, which we have to look at maxima and minima on the on these curves here. I'll cleverly draw it, so yeah, I guess there is one right here. And whenever you see one of those, you have to include this Perron Frobenius eigenvector factor. And you need to do that in order for the circle to count this factor delta. Delta is the Perron Frobenius eigenvalue. If you don't do that, then it doesn't work. So you have some kind of planar algebra in which you can't throw away circles and calculate delta and multiply by delta. Okay, and in this planar algebra, the dimension of P0, as I said, is not 1, as one might like. It's the number of vertices in gamma 1. Right, now, so that's all the old stuff. All, everything I said there was about is at least 10 years old. So now we come to the graded algebra structure I've had around in my, batting around in my head for over 10 years, but it's never really paid off. So here it is. Here's what I'm going to call the first graded algebra structure. So it's very simple. Remember this, the mantra, you know, every tangle gives an operation. So here's a tangle. Just it's a very simple tangle. You just put two of the things next to each other. You don't connect them at all. Okay? Then this gives another associative multiplication on the planar algebra. But notice this time, the multiplication goes, it doesn't preserve each one of the PNs. It goes from PN plus PM to PN plus M. There's M here, M there, then you've got N plus M. Okay, so this is a graded algebra multiplication. This is what's called, makes the direct sum of the PNs into what's called a graded algebra. Okay? And it's a star algebra, it's a star just by flipping everything around. It's clearly an anti thing. So it makes it into a star algebra. Okay, so. So this is the old result that I had at least 10 years ago, that as a graded algebra, if you start with a subfactor planar algebra, you do this and you take the graded algebra, you get nothing very exciting. What you get is, one way to get graded algebras is to actually take the full tensor algebra of some vector space. We all know about that, Fock space and so on. So if you do that with a graded thing to start with, and just take its full graded tensor algebra, you're going to get a graded algebra, okay, of the simplest kind. Well, the result says that, in fact, the graded algebra structure of a planar algebra is nothing but a full graded tensor algebra. And another way to say this result, this sort of looks rather mysterious, but my co-authors have still not got getting to the bottom of this notation, but. All this actually translates to in terms of loops is that you can write a loop as, you know, first time it comes back to the star and second time and so on. That's all it is. So and the graded structure is just concatenation of loops. So it's very simple. Just as a graded algebra, there's not really much interest in looking at the planar algebras. However, one had the hope that something was going on. And now here we come to the big new idea, which is no, that's a good remark. There's no shading problem. The shading just goes along. This is unshaded. That's unshaded. It's not the fusion one. Oh, yeah. And by the way, if you take this and you take the case of the following graph, this is, I should emphasize this heavily. If you take the following graph. That bipartite graph, then you get the planar algebra you get is the non-commutative polynomials in as many variables as there are edges here. Okay, so the sort of usual free probability stuff for self-adjoint matrices is going to be built on that graph. And to be strictly correct, it's only the even part because of my obsession with the even number of boundary points on the disks. I could throw that away actually at this point and just say it really is correct. Okay. Anyway, here's a new idea. It's come straight from what Dima and Alice were doing, what Alice was telling us about this morning. And it's not even going to use the potential, at least for the result that we're going to get. We're simply going to define a trace on this graded algebra in the following way. We're going to take an element A, which is, you know, goes in one of these vector spaces, and we're going to take the following tangle. This should, once again, this should really, strictly speaking, be a big disk outside here to say that we're in P0, but it's completely redundant. So we just take it, it's in the product, if you like, with each individual temporal loop diagram, Kaufman diagram, and add them up. Okay, add them up. Why add them up? Well, that's what you do in random matrices for some reason. And this was always the sticking point in making a connection between planar algebra and random matrices, and still is, in spite of this. You want to add everything up. You never look at the individual ones and say, aha, this guy has wonderful properties. You just add them all up. Okay? So we do that. We add them all up. Why not? Okay. Well, we all agree, actually, let me get into that. This is kind of interesting point here, about why is that a trace? I spell it out, just in case. Just in case you don't get, you know, I haven't beaten it in enough, here's an explicit writing of the trace of A, where A has six edges coming out. There's the five different temporally lead diagrams on top of it, and so you take A and then you close it in all these five different ways, add it up, and you get a scalar. And that's the trace of A. Okay. So, examples. Right, in the temporally lead thing, suppose that A itself is a temporally lead tangle. Okay, well, each time you close it off with one, you're going to get some power of delta. Okay, so you're going to get some horrible polynomial in delta within the coefficients. That's going to be the trace of an arbitrary temporally lead element. In the case of the non-commuting random variables, in this case here, then what do I say? You get the trace. You can easily check that you get the trace. Well, this is Wolkowski, right? That such that when you complete this non-commuting random variable thing, non-commuting polynomials, you get the free group 2-1 factor. Okay, so we're on an interesting track now. We have got a 2-1 factor, free group 2-1 factor, coming up in now in the formalism of planar algebras from this particular graph. We know, because of Wolkowski, for sure, very solid, it is a free group 2-1 factor, nothing more solid than that. Okay, and we haven't used a potential, right? If we were using a potential, we'd put more complicated things than Kaufman temporary pictures. Now, spin models, that's another kind of graph. It's this one. Then you get another embedding, actually, of the planar algebra inside non-commuting polynomials, which I think I'm going to make explicit in a second. And there you can also deduce from Wolkowski that you get a 2-1 factor of free group kind from this particular trace. So here's how these embeddings go. Just to sort of, I don't want to hide anything from you. I don't want you to go away thinking that I was keeping something to myself. So in the case of the vertex model, so that is to say this bipartite graph, if you took this picture here, these two cups, then the element of the non-commuting polynomial algebra that you get is this one, sigma xi squared xj squared. There's an xi there, xi there, xj there, xj there. And if you took these two cups embedded, you would get the sum of xi, xj, xj, xi. Again, that's how it goes. Now, in the spin model world, with that other graph, you get a different embedding, and here the x's are really in the regions, but they sort of count at each edge of the region. So the embedding for them, this double cup, would actually go to the element sigma of xi to the fourth. So rather different embeddings in the non-commutative polynomial algebra. And now here's a little exercise for you. I promised Kevin that I'd write this formula up explicitly. Since we have a trace, we can talk about moments of elements. And this is our favorite element for various reasons, which I'll hopefully come to later on, this simple element cup. Now you see, cup is not a particularly exciting element in the old point of view, right, in this TQFT point of view, because if you just spread it around, it would just become that element, and that's the identity of the first algebra, no interest whatsoever. But if you start multiplying it by itself, then you get some non-trivial stuff. Okay, and you can calculate its moments, right? So you can see in the case of the non-commuting random variables, the polynomials, you'd be raising this thing to some high power, all right? So it's highly non-trivial. But so you can do it's not that hard an exercise to show that the moment generating function for cup, this element, so the trace of the high powers is this function here. So it's algebraic, of course, as we expect from Greg's talk yesterday, naturally. An algebraic function. And in fact, without the detail, I imagine the trace of any polynomial in the Temporally-Lieb, any element in the Temporally-Lieb algebra would be an algebraic function. That's a guess, but I'm sure it's true. All right.
Any specific element would be a polynomial.
Yeah. So any element in the Temporally-Lieb algebra should give you an algebraic moment generating function for this multiplication. It's not the old multiplication, yeah. Alright, so now we come to our first theorem. We have some theorems. So I've been talking about this case as if it were a nice trace, and we know in the case of this particular bipartite graph that it is a nice trace. It's the one that gives a free group 2-1 factor. So our first theorem is that the trace that we've defined on this GR, maybe I didn't point it out before, GR means the graded algebra. So we have this algebra, which is a direct sum, has this graded product corresponding to the product of monomials in the non-commutative polynomial business. This trace is a nice trace, it's a positive definite trace. positive definite. You know, if you're in the usual subject of where you would expect it to be positive semi-definite, and you have to do a quotient and so on, but no, it's a positive definite trace. No arguing with it. And so how do you prove this? Briefly, first of all, there's two properties. There's positivity, which is the main one, but there's also the trace property, and I'd like to do this a bit slowly because I'm still hoping that someone's going to come up after one of these talks and say, aha, this is what you're talking about here. Anyway, there's a special tangle, which has a big role to play in planar algebra. It's this rotation tangle, where you rotate everything by two. And here's the commutativity property of these graded algebras. So on each Pn, there's an action of the cyclic group of order n, given by this rotation tangle. Okay? So it's sort of cyclic commutative in the following sense, that if you take A and multiply it by B and take the rotation, rotate that the degree of A times, you actually get B times A. So this is, you know, it's not completely hopelessly non-commutative. There is an action of the cyclic group on each graded part which fixes up the commutativity for you. So just like with differential forms or exterior algebra, we have an action of the cyclic group in every degree by a sign, okay, which fixes up commutativity. And in fact, you can redefine the product in differential forms so that this is exactly the formula for the commutativity of differential forms. That's a bit funny because we all know that in differential forms you have the degree of A times the degree of B because you've got to pass all these things around. But if you do things right, you just need the degree of A. Okay, so, you know, there's some sort of notion of commutativity for graded algebras with cyclic group action, and ordinary commutativity is no action of the cyclic group. Differential form commutativity is the cyclic group acting by signs, and then in general, it's the cyclic group acting by this, what we call the generalized Fourier transform in the business. Right. Now, anyway, this same idea allows you to show that this trace has the trace property, that the trace of AB is the trace of BA, because here's the trace of A times B. Now, the sum of the temporally lead things is obviously cyclically invariant, so you can just rotate this whole picture and bring A over to the other side. Okay, so it is a trace. Right, people are asking an extremely good question, and the answer is a priori yes, because of the work of Dima and of Alice especially. You could take a non-trivial potential in temporally lead, okay? Then when you do this power series expansion, the rule of powers of beta, we know that if beta is small, that's actually going to honestly converge. So it will converge, now that we have planar algebra, we don't have to muck around with monomials all the time. These things can be honest elements, and so it will be an honest element of temporally lead. It will obviously be cyclically invariant and give the trace by the formula that Alice was giving us this morning. So a priori there are other cyclic invariant ones that give us positive definite traces, at least in the case of this non-commuting random variables. So I mean that's one of the things that we're working on now, of course, is we're trying to extend this work, and you know we're trying to answer that question simply by looking at elements of temporary lead that are rotationally invariant and do give positive definite, or at least positive semi-definite in the products. And with at least I'm thinking of these as a sort of toy model for what you get from the potential. And the potential, the formula is incredibly complicated, but you could just write down explicit linear combinations of temporary lead elements which are cyclically invariant and see what you get out of those. All right. Well, I'm going to have to hurry up because what's the time I'm supposed to stop? 10:02. Well, I'm not going to stop at 10:02. People do this to me all the time, so it's my turn. Right, so now positivity of this in the product is not an obvious thing, right? We're used to, you know, one of the basic axioms of planar algebra is that you have this positive definite inner product, but we mucked around with the inner product. In particular, the spaces Pn, the different spaces Pn are no longer orthogonal, right? Because if you take the trace of AB star, is going to involve all kinds of things mixing them up. So no reason why if this is in one space and this is another space, of different gradings why they should be zero in product. In fact, they're not. So this whole process, you know, the stuff that people did way back, you know, about orthogonality and diagonalizing this matrix of inner products. So it all has to be done again. And I looked on the computer at a few of these inner product matrices, and it's kind of interesting. You see, as the number of strings gets bigger, you get all of the friendly polynomials, these Chebyshev polynomials coming up. But then there's some other little polynomials which come up, and then they disappear. And then as you get higher and higher, there's new little funny polynomials, and they come up and disappear. And the only ones that seem to stay are the Chebyshev ones that we're used to from positive definiteness. Okay. Well, anyway, our first theorem is that this inner product is positive definite. And we knew it in this case from Voiculescu in Fox space. Okay. And we have two proofs of this. One is by the random matrix model method. Remember, Aries emphasized that one thing that was obvious from her formalism is that the inner product you get is positive. Okay, so we can do it that way. Or we can do it by Fox space. So we have to do a Fox space, which is a bit more general than the Fox space adapted to the graph, right? So we said that this graph here gives you non-commutative polynomials, this graph here gives you something else. Every bipartite graph will give you a Fox space, and the Fox space is going to be, the basis for it is going to be various paths on the graph, starting from some point, ending at some other point. And if you do everything right, take into account the parameter Frobenius eigenvector and so on, you can set things up so that the trace becomes the vacuum expectation value. And one nice remark in there is that we're really, in order for it to be natural, we're forced into type 3 situation because of this parameter Frobenius eigenvector. But the loops, you see, the path is going to give you something that's naturally type 3, but the loops, everything compensates, and you're actually in the centralizer of the state given by the vacuum expectation value. Okay, so yeah, the usual story. It's the Perron Frobenius eigenvector for the adjacency matrix of the graph. We have to pick one. We have to assume one exists and pick one. Okay. Don't worry, we have thought of these things. So the way you do it is, just in a little bit more detail, you have, for each edge on the graph, you have a creation operator for the edge, you have an adjoint which destroys the edge, and you represent paths instead of, as you might do in graph C-star algebras, you represent paths on gamma by these sums of LE plus LE star. That's, of course, the key to getting these, you know, the free probability combinatorics in. Okay? All right, so, you know, those of you who know Voiculescu will know that that's exactly what you do in the case of non-commuting polynomials. Our second theorem is that if P is a planar, subfractive planar algebra, which remember the thing that's important there is the dimension of P0 is 1, the factor condition, then when we take our graded algebra, the planar algebra, and complete it up using the GNS, and it's now giving us a positive definite scalar product, we get a 2-1 factor. Okay? And of course it won't be hyperfinite. We would never expect it to be hyperfinite. You know, try and exhibit for me a finite dimensional subalgebra of this from the pictures and you won't get one. Okay, so, and we have a conjecture as to what it should be in terms of the free groups. The Dema hasn't proved that for us yet. No, certainly, just like Serene's thing. Yeah, we could probably easily prove something again. I mean, we could probably very easily exhibit free products inside there. So here's our second theorem, is that you get a subfactor. And the proof uses, interestingly enough, this cup element, which this tiny little element seems to be at the center of the whole game, you see. So what we use, in fact, is that it has no atoms in its spectrum. We use a Sir Hilbert Schmidt kind of argument to get anything in the center to be actually a scalar. So we use this element to prove, we look at the phenomena that were generated by cup, and we show it's maximal abelian. So it's like the so-called radial subalgebra. It's very similar to the radial subalgebra that people have looked at, and indeed Dima proved that it's singular maximal abelian subalgebra. And you see, once you've got that, then all you've got to do is get something else that doesn't commute well with cup, and you're done. Because it's something that is in the center, it's got to commute with cup, it's got to be in the phonemic algebra generated by cup, and if you try to make it commute with that, you find you're stuffed. It doesn't. So that makes it a factor. And those are a factor in which this the phonemic algebra generated by these two has trivial relative commutant. Okay. So that was the technique for that. So thus we have a 2-1 factor associated to every subfactor planar algebra. So we've got a 2-1 factor, so the natural question is where's the subfactor? Okay, and the second question is closely related, how much of the planar algebra structure have we actually used? So all we used was the concatenation and those temporary Lieb pictures. Added them up. Well, actually, think about it, it's quite a lot of the planar algebra structure you've really used went into the trace. But there's still something missing, and that's going to give us a subfactor. So in order to get there, I have to define more graded algebra structures on this whole game. So I'm going to start off with the one that we just defined, where we just put them next door to each other. And then the next product is going to be put them next door and make one single contraction in between them. Okay? So that's just as associative, just as star, and so on. And then you can keep on going and make k contractions between them. Of course, in order to be able to make these contractions, you have to start off already at Pn. You can't start at P0. Okay, so we do that. It has star algebra structure just the same. And the trace, we do the same thing for the trace. We just contract the first k with the last k and put the sum of the temporary Lieb elements in the middle. Okay. So the theorem that we had extends to all the traces on all of these higher graded algebra structures give 2-1 factors. And once again, we do it by the Fox base. But here's the neat thing, that we get a sort of mixture of the UHF inside this Fox acting on the Fox base and the free thing acting on the Fox base. We just, you know, to represent the path now and run these higher things, we just do straight creation, then we do these sums of creation and annihilation, and then we do straight annihilation. You find when you multiply those things together, you get exactly that graded structure with the one contraction. Okay, so hurrying right along. I'm actually not that far from the end now. I will be.
I'm willing to sacrifice everybody's pocket rate, so you know, go ahead.
I'll make you. Right, I'm not very far from the end. So now I want to give you the subfactor. So it's n contained in m. The big one is the first graded, so with one contraction. And then the small one is our friend that we started with, the simple graded algebra. Okay? So this is m, is the sum of all the things from n greater than or equal to 1 with this one contraction. And n, which we have to embed in there, and we embed it in there simply by using the last planar algebra structure we hadn't used, namely, we join them around the back. Okay, so now we've used everything in the planar algebra structure. There's some hope of recovering the planar algebra from it. And just as an exercise, a trivial exercise, you can check that if you take the multiplication in M and restrict it to N, you get the multiplication in N. It's simply because you go up and down and up. Simple pictures. Everything now from now on is pictures. And I think I'm on my last transparency, except for one that I can leave out. Thanks. So here's the last theorem, and then I'll stop, is that the tower for n contained in m, you remember in the subfactors you have, whenever you have n contained in m, you have this basic construction which you iterate, and so on. Well, that tower is exactly our higher graded algebras, which you complete. So you have these more and more contractions. And the higher relative commutants for that tower coincide with the planar algebra you started with. Okay, so we have, this is in index not equal to 1. An index equal to 1, curiously enough, it fails. It doesn't hurt much. But so we've reproved Popper's theorem. We've got, for any planar algebra, we've constructed a 2-1 factor, and we have this graded product, and we've managed to identify the higher relative commutants of this graded product subfactor with the planar algebra we started with all of the planar algebra structure as well. And this picture here just shows you how these relative commutants are actually contained in the the higher grade the odds of this. And the proof basically goes through the same thing. We use this cup and double cup, and you know, the fact that it's very hard to commute with both of those, and that forces the commutants to be in these algebras. And now I'm going to stop. Thanks. Well, non-crossing partitions is sort of is another name for temporally lieb. There are genuine non-crossing partitions in this particular... If you do the thing for this particular graph here, you will find that what the temporally lieb diagrams are there is literally non-crossing partitions. But no matter what plane of algebra you have, you get the same pictures, they just mean something different. And they're not always non-crossing partitions, but they're always ways of joining the boundary to the boundary without any crossings. In the first graded or the zero graded? You're looking at it. Nothing. It's just the vacuum. In the first graded one, it's this. It's cup. Obviously, right? You multiply that by itself. Get it back. Multiply it by anything, it won't change it. And I have pictures there that I was going to show you of all the EIs in the tower and how you get the normal subfactor yoga out of that, but I've already used up the time. Dima. No, it's not that. The issue of spherical invariance is one that just adds a layer of complexity that we want to avoid. I mean, it has to do with the non-extremal subfactors, but not to do with rotation by one. That's a different issue. I mean, in the non-spherical case, things are still... Well, I don't know, maybe you're right. Maybe there's something to be looked at there. Because the spherical symmetry does sort of have some way of going, you know, what spherical symmetry is about is, if you have, let's talk about it.